So we began last week. This is still all my introduction. Next week, we'll start into the book, okay? Next week, we will, work through the first chapter. We'll see how long it takes us to get through the first chapter. But I expanded last week's notes. Yeah. So we covered pages 1 through 3 last week. Tonight we're going to cover pages 4 and 5 in these handouts. So last week, we asked the question, what can we expect from the book of Daniel? And so we talked about how famous some of its stories are, and yet what a difficult book it is to read, and the reasons why it's difficult. And so then we looked at the way Daniel put together his book and drew some conclusions from it, saw what he's trying to do, well, not just trying, but what he did, and what are some of the key concepts and themes there, and what kind of help and encouragement we can anticipate. This is without even getting into the text. That's what we did last week. This week, there's two questions I want us to consider before we jump into the book of Daniel. You see them right there in your notes. The first one is, well, where does the book of Daniel fit into the larger Old Testament story? Where does it fit into that story? And then the second question is, what, since Daniel was written about life in captivity in Babylon, the second question we want to ask ourselves before we jump into the book of Daniel is, what is expected? Or I guess I probably should have put that in the past tense. What was expected of the exiles living in Babylon? They're still not there. They're not still there. So nothing's expected of them now. What was expected of the exiles living in Babylon? And we're going to see when we go through that question, we're going to ask another question, and that is, does that have any application or relevance to us? So this first question, where does the book of Daniel fit in the larger Old Testament story? Interesting thing is you're probably just familiar with the Christian Bible, right? In the Christian Bible, when you just turn to the book of Daniel, you knew that Daniel is placed among the prophets, right? The last of the major prophets. So that's where you turn to. But in the Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew canon, Daniel is not among the prophets. Daniel is among the historical books, and we'll look at that in just a moment. But let me just say this: if anybody's hungry, you can join Nick in the back there. I'm just kidding you, Nick. The fact that Daniel is not among the prophets, but in the historical books in the Hebrew Bible, after last week anyway, that fact should not surprise us. Because we looked at that. We saw that the first 6 chapters of Daniel narrate the historical highlights of Daniel's service in the Babylonian and Persian courts. Remember that? During the 70 years of exile and beyond, Daniel served in the Babylonian and Persian courts, and those first 6 chapters narrate historical highlights from that. And so the first six chapters of Daniel pick up the biblical storyline at the exile and continues it. That's why he's placed where he is in the Hebrew canon. Now, we're going to get into what the Hebrew canon looks like in a minute. You can already see a diagram that I've got there in your notes. But first of all, I want to make some comments about it. You're going to see when we look in the Hebrew Bible, especially when we look in the second half of it, you're going to see there's some significant differences. So I need to make a few comments before we start looking at that. The Hebrew Bible and Christian Old Testament contain the same books. Okay? They have the exact same books. But the order or the arrangement of those books are much different. We'll see in a moment. But let me just make this statement. Neither arrangement, the Hebrew Bible or the Christian Old Testament, neither arrangement is wrong. It's not a right or wrong thing here. It's just that they're different. Same books, different arrangement. And that different arrangement doesn't change the meaning of the text or doesn't affect the meaning of the text. Remember, the Bible that Jesus and the apostles used was the Hebrew canon arranged, like what we see here on the table. They didn't have the Christian Bible arrangement of the Old Testament. They had the Hebrew Bible arrangement of the Old Testament. That was their Bible. That was the Bible that Jesus and the apostles used. Now, technically, a Greek translation of it, but this is the arrangement they read from. And here's Mary. Oh, no, this is Brenda. Okay, so in the Hebrew Bible, I still have some more notes to get worked through here. Here's why I'm bringing this up, the arrangement of the Hebrew Bible. It's because the Hebrew Bible shows very clearly where Daniel fits into the larger story of the Old Testament. It doesn't jump out at you in the way that the Old Testament books are arranged in the Christian Bible. In the Hebrew Bible, it jumps out at you where Daniel fits into the larger Old Testament story. The book of Kings ends with the fall and captivity of Jerusalem, of Judah, to Babylon. You can read that in 2 Kings 25. That's the last chapter of Kings, 1 and 2 Kings. The book of Daniel picks up the storyline at that point. We see that in the first two verses of Daniel 1. It picks up the storyline where 2 Kings 25 leaves off and continues it through the 70 years of exile. We've got some new people here. I've only got one book. I'll order some more books. So let me say this before we get into it. I'm not expecting you to memorize this arrangement and all that, but I find it very interesting. It helps us understand what's going on in the Old Testament. You really see the storyline here. Look at this. In the Hebrew canon, the Old Testament books are divided up into three groups: the law, the prophets, and the writings. Some of you've probably heard that before. The Old Testament books are divided up into the law, the prophets, the writings. Notice the law, first five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. These books, these five books, begin the story. They go from creation to Moses' death. And that's the law. And the reason those are law or why, can surely anybody got a wild guess as to why those five books are called the law? That's right. The Ten Commandments and the whole Mosaic Law are given in these books. And it's restated in Deuteronomy. So that's why those books are law. That's the type of material it is, law. Okay? So it's called the law. And the law begins the Old Testament story. Okay? It begins the story. And it goes from creation to Moses' death. The next section in the Hebrew Bible is the prophets. And you've got two groups here. The first of them is called the narrative books, the former prophets. And there, you can just read this right in your notes. They're Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings. These books pick up from the death of Moses and continue the story. It continues the story from entry into the promised land to the Babylonian exile. Okay? Now, the next group is of the prophets. They're called the latter prophets. And they're much different material than the former prophets. You may be asking, why do they call Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, why do they call them the former prophets? Why? What do we call them in the Christian Bible? Historical books or narrative. They call them the former prophets because we don't know exactly who wrote it, who wrote those books. But ancient Jewish tradition on almost all of those books has prophets writing it. For instance, they say Samuel wrote Judges and a good part of 1 Samuel, and his disciples wrote the rest of 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. Samuel died in 1 Samuel 25, so clearly he didn't write 2 Samuel, okay? Kings. They believe that the ancient rabbis, their tradition is that Jeremiah wrote most of Kings. So Joshua, Judges, Samuels, and Kings, the tradition is prophets wrote those. So that's why they call them the former prophets. But what I want you to notice here with this next group of prophets, the latter prophets, the storyline breaks. So in the law, you started the biblical story. And it runs from creation to Moses' death. In the former prophets, you continued the storyline. It goes from entry into the promised land to the exile. And then the storyline stops. And what you have in Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and by the way, this is the order they are in the Hebrew Bible. Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Isaiah, Book of the 12, the minor prophets were all in one book, and it was called the Book of the 12. They did not continue the storyline. What they did, what the prophets that wrote those books did, is they reflected on the story of Israel and explained about what's going on, explained and confronted the Israelites about disobedience or obedience, about judgment or blessing. They were speeches. And doesn't, when you're reading through those books, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Isaiah, and the 12 minor prophets, doesn't it read like, well, this is no longer narrative. This is just like a whole collection of speeches. And that's what they are. Jeremiah is a collection of his speeches. And in those speeches, he's reflecting on what has happened in Israel and explaining what's happening as a result of Israel's disobedience. And it's the same thing in the others' prophets. So they're treated as commentary on the story. So the story goes from creation to the Babylonian exile, and then these major and minor prophets, they are looking at that story and delivering speeches of reproof and words of judgment and promise from God. Okay? Don't worry if you're not memorizing all this. It's written in front of you and it's not critical. I just want you to see how the Old Testament works. And then you have the writings. The writings are the wisdom books, and it has wisdom books and narrative books. Okay? Look under the wisdom books there. The wisdom books are Psalms, and by the way, in the Hebrew Bible, the book of Ruth is attached as almost like an introduction to the Psalms. Because remember, Ruth is the story of David's origin. And so in the Hebrew Bible, they've got Ruth prefixed to the Psalms. Kind of interesting, isn't it? But anyway, and really, when you read through Ruth, the message there is the relentless kindness of God, but probably the primary reason it is there is to show how the relentless kindness of God to an Israelite widow resulted in the birth of David. That was the origin of David. And so you can understand that's probably why they prefixed it to the to the Psalms. How many books have you read where it's a biography? How many books have you read where at the beginning sometimes they'll have a little biographical sketch of the author? That's kind of how you can think of what they're doing there by sticking Ruth at the beginning of Psalms. But then Psalms, Job, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, and Lamentations. These books continue the commentary. Again, they're wisdom literature or their songs of lament, as well as other kinds of songs and all of that. But that wisdom, material and those songs, they're all commenting on the law and what Israel has gone through, what their story has been, how things have developed. So it's still commentary. Then notice, and here's how it just jumps out to us. In the writings, the other part of the writings is the narrative books. Daniel, Esther, Ezra, Nehemiah, Chronicles. These books go back to 2 Kings and pick up the storyline and continue it through the exile. Okay? Does that make sense? I don't know about you, but I mean, you just don't make a big deal out of this. But just sometimes go back and review that, and it can help you understand what's going on as you're reading through the Old Testament. Especially understanding that the major prophets and minor prophets and the wisdom books, they're not part of the overall storyline. They are commentary on it. That's, I think, really helpful. And the storyline doesn't get picked up again until Daniel. That's where Daniel fits in to the whole Old Testament story. Now, we could spend, there's books written on how the Hebrew canon is arranged and the theological significance of that, okay? I just gave you a whirlwind tour, just a thumbnail sketch. You can see how when Jesus and the apostles read the Old Testament, when it came to Daniel, they knew that Daniel was picking up the storyline of the larger story at the end of the exile and carrying it through. And they knew that. And Daniel, in his book, he did not, none of these books in the writings here, the narrative books in the writings, completed the story. The story was incomplete at the end of this canon. But the completion was left wide open. And of course, Daniel tells us it's the Son of Man. It's a king like the Son of Man that's going to complete the story. And so we'll see that more as we go through the book of Daniel. Anyway, this is as technical as we're going to get, hopefully, going through this. But I hope it was useful to you, helpful to you. Anyway, that's where Daniel fits into the larger Old Testament story. That's why Daniel begins the way that he begins. The next question that I wanted to ask when Daniel, in Daniel 1 and 2, 1 through 4, let me just read Daniel 1 through 4. Daniel writes this: in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, and with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. You can read about that deportation in 2 Kings 25. Daniel's picking it up from there. That's why he opens up his book that way. So now, in my notes, I've got here, Daniel opens with an account of the initial stage of Nebuchadnezzar's conquest of Jerusalem. These first four verses, that's the initial stage. And Nebuchadnezzar had many of the nobility, including Daniel and his three friends, deported. These events that Daniel recorded here in the first four verses of Daniel 1 took place in 605 BC. There would be two additional stages in this conquest. See, this first stage, he didn't sack Jerusalem. He didn't burn it. He didn't take the king. He came and he took the vessels from their god and put them in his house, which indicates my God beat your God. That's what that indicates, okay? He deported many out of the royal family and the nobility, some of the elite in the country. Okay, that was the first stage of the captivity. There would be two additional stages in Babylon's conquest of Judah. In 597 BC, so 8 years later, Nebuchadnezzar comes and deports everybody, just about everybody. Ezekiel was among the deportees in 597, in that second stage. Ezekiel was deported then, taken to Babylon. And also, Jehoiakim, who is the son of Jehoiakim. Notice in Daniel 1:1, Jehoiakim was king. Don't you just love the way they make these names so similar? Jehoiakim was king of Judah in 605 BC when Nebuchadnezzar first laid siege to Jerusalem. But by this second stage, Jehoiakim's son, Jehoiakim, was king, and Nebuchadnezzar removed him and replaced him with Jehoiakim's uncle, Mattaniah. And he renamed Mattaniah Zedekiah. And so when you read, we'll see in Jeremiah and other places, Zedekiah is referred to. He's an evil king, obviously a puppet king of Nebuchadnezzar. That was in 597. And then 9 years later in 586, or 11 years later, I guess, in 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar came, and this is the third stage, and there was nothing left of Jerusalem for a fourth stage. In 586, the Babylonians came, and Jerusalem was sacked. The temple and the palace were burned, and much of the wall was destroyed. And that's the condition that the exiles found Jerusalem in when they returned. So, three stages. What Daniel records here in Daniel 1 is that first stage, 605 BC. So, think about this. Nebuchadnezzar comes, and he deports a lot of people, many from the royal family and the nobility, as well as all of the vessels out of the temple to show that his God trumped your God. Okay? And, but there's still a king in Jerusalem, right? Jehoiakim was a king in Jerusalem. Now, he was supposed to obey Nebuchadnezzar. And he did for a little bit, and then he didn't. And then we had then Nebuchadnezzar killed him, and Jehoiakim was on the throne, and Nebuchadnezzar came and put his own puppet king in 597, installed him. But anyway, just think about this situation. Daniel and his friends and all the other exiles that went to Babylon initially, they're in Babylon. There's still a king in Jerusalem, okay? So what we find, and we'll see this in the book of Jeremiah, what we find is that initially, in the early years of the captivity, the exile, there were false prophets among the exiles in Babylon, and they were prophesying that the captivity would be brief. All right. Also in Jerusalem around Jehoiakim, there were false prophets. Like the main one is Hananiah. You can read about him in Jeremiah 28. They were also prophesying that the captivity would be brief. What's their evidence? There's still a king in Jerusalem. God's going to break the Babylonian captivity. He still has a king in Jerusalem. It'll be brief. And so, these false prophets were telling the Israelites in Babylon, do not build homes and settle down in this unclean land. The captivity is going to be brief. We still have a king in Jerusalem. God's going to break the yoke of Nebuchadnezzar on the Israelites. So you might not have noticed that, but in the early days of the captivity, that was a huge issue that was going on, both in Jerusalem and in Babylon. These false prophets misleading the exiles. And I'm not going to say much more because we're going to work through these questions and we're going to look at God's response to that. But what I do want to point out is that because of that situation, the prophet Jeremiah wrote a letter to the exiles. We see that letter. We can read that letter in Jeremiah 29. And so that's what we're going to do the rest of this evening. We're going to go to Jeremiah 29, also some verses in 28. And you thought you were going to be in Daniel tonight, didn't you? We're going to look at this letter that Jeremiah wrote to the exiles. And I want us to look at this letter with an eye to, is there any relevance for us in our situation today? For believers in our situation today. So, question number one. Let me read a couple of passages out of Jeremiah 28 and 29. 28 verses 10 and 11. The question is, what were those false prophets in Jerusalem and in Babylon predicting? What were they predicting? And look at the words of Hananiah, who is in Jerusalem. Verses 10 and 11, look what he said. I mean, the whole conversation between Hananiah and Jeremiah starts at verse 1, but what I'm getting at is found in verses 10 and 11. Then the prophet Hananiah took the yoke bars from the neck of Jeremiah the prophet and broke them. And Hananiah spoke in the presence of all the people, saying, thus says the Lord, even so will I break the yoke of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, from the neck of all the nations within 2 years. But Jeremiah the prophet went his way. So what was Hananiah predicting? Yeah, how short? Yeah, it would end within 2 years. It's pretty funny. I mean, if you go back and read the whole story, Jeremiah's got this yoke on him because he'd been in stocks and that sort of thing. But he's got this yoke on him, and it's a wooden yoke. So Hananiah comes up and breaks that yoke and said, that's what the Lord's going to do to the Babylonian yoke. God's got a pretty good answer to Hananiah that we're going to look at a little bit later. But anyway, and you can see in chapter 29, that's what Hananiah was predicting in the king's ear in Jerusalem. Look in 29, verses 8 and 9. This is in the letter. Verse 1, first four verses, first three verses explains the writing of the letter, and verse 4 starts the actual contents of the letter. In verses 8 and 9, Jeremiah in his letter says this, for thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, do not let your prophets and your diviners who are among you deceive you, and do not listen to the dreams that they dream. For it is a lie that they are prophesying to you in my name. I did not send them, declares the Lord. And so we know what lie they were propagating, that the captivity would end within 2 years, right? So let me ask you this. What's the fundamental issue here? What was going on? What was the issue that God was getting at in confronting them about their false prophets giving lying predictions? What was the fundamental issue? You can see that in verse. Don't let them deceive you. But what's behind that? Why are the false prophets lying about the captivity? Why are they predicting a short captivity? What's the fundamental issue here? I think you can see that in chapter 28, verses 12 through 17, particularly verse 17. Let me just read that. It's an interesting exchange. God's response to Hananiah. Sometime after the prophet Hananiah had broken the yoke bars from off the neck of Jeremiah the prophet, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah. Go tell Hananiah, thus says the Lord, you have broken wooden bars, but you have made in their place bars of iron. For thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, I have put upon the neck of all these nations an iron yoke to serve Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and they shall serve him, for I have given to him even the beasts of the field. And Jeremiah the prophet said to the prophet Hananiah, listen, Hananiah, the Lord has not sent you. And you have made this people trust in a lie. Therefore, thus says the Lord, behold, I will remove you from the face of the earth. This year you shall die because you uttered rebellion against the Lord. In that same year, in the seventh month, the prophet Hananiah died. And I meant especially verse 16, not 17. So what in verse 16, what is identified as the basic fundamental issue over the length of the captivity? He's got control, and so what are the false prophets doing with respect to that? Rebelling. They're rebelling. It's rebellion. In other words, the issue is submit to this. The false prophets and the ruling echelon in Jerusalem that don't want it, they're rebelling against it. The false prophets are enabling the rebellion by providing these false predictions, okay? So the fundamental issue here with the Israelites is, no, you broke my covenant. I told you in Deuteronomy 4, I told you in Deuteronomy 28 and 29, or 28, what the result of that, what the consequences of that is going to be. And during the reign of Manasseh, God determined he's going to send Judah into captivity and announce that fact. So this is what the Lord is doing. You have broke the covenant. This is the consequence. I have given Jehoiakim into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. And the false prophets and those that are in cahoots with them, the politicians that are in cahoots with them, are rebelling, are refusing to submit to the captivity, to the exile. That's the fundamental issue, refusing to submit to it. Are you going to submit or not? Now, listen to what... Let me just start at verse 1 and read through here. But I want you to listen in verses 4 through 6, what Jeremiah tells the exiles to do while in captivity. These are the words of the letter that Jeremiah the prophet sent from Jerusalem to the surviving elders of the exiles, of the exiles, and to the priests, the prophets, and all the people whom Nebuchadnezzar had taken into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. This was after King Jeconiah and the queen mother, the eunuchs, the officials of Judah and Jerusalem, the craftsmen and the metal workers had departed from Jerusalem. The letter was sent by the hand of Elisha, the son of Shaphan, and Gemariah, the son of Hilkiah, whom Zedekiah, king of Judah, sent to Babylon, to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. It said, and here's the letter, listen to what he says to the exiles. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon, build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there, do not decrease. So, what is he telling them to do here? Live their lives normally. Exactly. What does that imply about the length of stay in Babylon? It's going to be a while. It's going to be a long stay. So what does he tell them to do? Tells them to build houses, yeah, plant gardens. Yeah, marry. Now, I want to say this. I want to point this out. When he was telling them, give your sons and daughters in marriage and multiply and increase, he wasn't saying have them marry Babylonians. Okay? He was saying the nation should not decrease while you're in this captivity. Build your homes, plant your gardens, eat your produce, marry off your kids within the nation of Israel. Marry off your kids. Increase, multiply. And now, look at verse 7. He says, if I can find it, but seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. So now what is he telling them in this verse to do? Yeah, what city? The bad city. Pray for the evil empire is what he's telling them to do, right? Why? Why is he telling them to pray for the welfare of the evil empire and its evil capital city? And this would apply to any city in Babylon, to where they were carried away to. He set it up. What set it up? How? What's he going to do? There. Go ahead. Second half of verse 7.
Well, that's how he's going to sustain his people. He's saying, I'm going to use the very thing that I've divinely set up to punish to also support you the whole time you're there.
Yeah. So he uses an evil empire, but he says, while you're in captivity, I'm going to bless Babylon. You pray for Babylon, I'm going to bless them because its welfare is going to be your welfare. That's the way I'm going to take care of you. You see that? Verse 7. So, let me ask you this. What should their mindset be toward the evil empire? I keep saying that for a reason. I'm trying to evoke negative feelings. What about Babylon? What should their mindset be toward Babylon? Submission to God, but right here, he's telling them, pray for Babylon. Its welfare is going to be your welfare. So what should their mindset toward? Well, should they, yeah, certainly rejoice, but should they be calling it the evil empire? Should they be thinking of it as the evil empire? Yeah, don't see them as the enemy. Exactly. See them as the means by which God is punishing disobedience, but at the same time taking care of his people. Now, here's the thing. Think about this. A lot of times in our Bible reading in the Old Testament, we have negative impression of exiles and of Babylon. And there's plenty of places where the Bible gives us a very negative view of Babylon, right? When's the last time you read Revelation 17 and 18? Or also, what is it, 13? 13, 17, and 18. Read those three chapters and see what kind of impression you get of Babylon, okay? And remember, Babylon was in the land of Shinar. What's the first thing that we read about in the land of Shinar in the Bible? Anybody remember? Genesis 11. Nimrod. Building the tower. That was in the land of Shinar. You know, so the land of Shinar and Babylon has been kind of a symbol of evil empire, evil worldwide empire throughout the story of the Bible. Okay? But here, as Pam said, the exiles are not to look at Babylon as the enemy, not to hate Babylon, but pray for them. Pray that God would bless Babylon, because in Babylon's welfare, his people will find their welfare. Now, does that have a New Testament ring to it at all? Yes, it does. Yes, it does. In that fourth question there, what was God's plan for them beyond the exile? Look at verses 10 through 14 in Jeremiah 29. Jeremiah continues in his letter. He says, "For thus says the Lord, when 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will visit you, and I will fulfill to you my promise and bring you back to this place. For I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will hear you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord, and I will restore your fortunes and gather you from all the nations and all the places where I have driven you, declares the Lord, and I will bring you back to the place from which I sent you into exile." Did he have a plan for them beyond the exile? Absolutely. So he's telling them, I'm using the exile as punishment. While you're in Babylon, the promised land is getting its Sabbath rests. And we'll get into that when we get into Daniel 9, okay? We'll get into 70, okay? We'll get into the number 70 in Daniel 9, okay? That's a little ways down the road. But while you're in captivity, the land, the promised land, is getting its Sabbath rest that it didn't get when you were in the promised land. And at the same time, I am blessing Babylon because that's the way I'm going to take care of you. Your welfare will be in Babylon's welfare. So submit to this. Settle down. Have that forward-looking focus. The Lord's got a plan in all of this. He is going to keep his promises. But at the same time, you submit to the captivity and you keep pursuing the Lord in that context. Yes. Oh, like a prosperity type of plan. Yes. Yes. We know why he is taking care of the nation Israel and providing for them and all of that, because through the nation Israel he's doing what? Raising up Jesus, the Messiah. And we're going to see that in these prophecies, particularly chapter 2, chapter 7, chapter 7 in particular. We're going to see that. Pardon? Yes, exactly. That's exactly what these exiles are supposed to do. Oh, the Babylonians and all that, they can see the Israelites' examples. That, yes, absolutely. No, you're right. And as a matter of fact, this is what I've read anyway. Every place the Jews have been carried off to, they have followed that. They have settled down. Whether it's Russia, other places, they have consciously followed this blueprint from Jeremiah. I thought that was pretty slick. On question four there, I said, we're not going to look at it, but I put down there, compare Deuteronomy 30, the first 10 verses. And what you'll see is you're going to see the exact same thing. I mean, Deuteronomy 28, verses 63 through 68, he talks about the captivity and exile. And then in Deuteronomy 30, verses 1 through 10, he talks about the plans he has for him, just like he discussed, just like he mentioned in Jeremiah, mentioned in his letter in verses 10 through 14. That tells us that God had this plan all along before that story even started. Okay? Now, here's the $65,000 question in question number five. Is Jeremiah's letter relevant to us nowadays regarding how we should live in this present world? Please explain.
I would say yes, and explain what's occurring to me is the
Right.
In other words, they weren't trusting God. They weren't following his plan for them in the promised land, so he sends them into exile. So already there's that issue. Now they're called in living the time of being in exile. He's saying the very thing that is a resultant of your not obeying me there, now I'm going to ask you to obey me here. So working through and submitting to those multi-layers of what God's doing in someone's life to care for them,
mm-hmm.
because he's fundamentally good, that absolutely speaks to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And think about the correspondence. The exiles in Babylon, were they living in an anti-God culture? Are we living in an anti-God, anti-Christian culture? Oh, I think so. And tons of questions, I mean, of passages just come to mind. What does Paul tell us to do every Sunday regarding the land that we're living in? This is a pop quiz. Yeah, Paul in 1 Timothy 2. Say that again. Pray for the leaders. Pray what regarding the leaders? Why? What's the purpose of praying for the leaders there in 1 Timothy 2? Yeah, so we can live godly and peacefully as we live godly. Yes. Ah, yes. It might be a little more focused. I'm not sure. Might be a little more focused simply because Christianity, it wasn't until what? Almost 300 years later that it became a legal religion. So I don't know if Paul's instructions were more focused on the fact that we're being persecuted or whether it extends even more. Pray for Rome because in her welfare, you'll have your welfare. It could be that. I mean, it certainly goes along with that. Yeah.
Paul talks about obeying authority.
Right.
It kind of like flows with Jeremiah. Like,
right. Yeah. Let me ask you this. It's time to go, but just parting thought here. Because there's so many other things I want to ask about this question five. I think you should think about this question five throughout the week. Jot down passages, because there's a ton of them in the New Testament that go right along with this. But let me throw another question out there for you to think about before the Lord throughout the week. What does this say about Christians engaging in Twitter wars with non-Christians or in Facebook wars with non-Christians about social issues? It's an anti-God, anti-Christian culture, right? So we're going to be thinking pretty differently than unbelievers in this country, right? Pretty differently. Let me ask you this. Let me put it this way. Twitter wars, Facebook wars, and all other kind of social media wars, or any kind of wars, yelling at each other at work or over the fence, does that fit with us submitting to God's plan for us to live as shining lights in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation? Philippians 2, you got a Bible on that.
The fact that it's so founded on leadership, you took Matthew, the second
Yeah. There is. And so you're going to be up against it all the time. But am I the only one? Do you guys see on social media these wars going on between Christian beliefs, people advocating Christian beliefs and those advocating differently? Think about that. Is that an example of living as shining lights in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation? If it's not, does that mean that we're not submitting to the situation that God's got us in right now as we're waiting for the final consummation of his kingdom, living in an anti-God, anti-Christ culture? Ryan. Yeah, I'm asking, is that the right thing to do? To argue.
Not
engage, you know. You can talk with them.
Right.
And probably most effective is talking face to face. But in those conversations, you're doing like what Pam said that Jeremiah is telling the exiles to do. Not to see the Babylonians as the enemy. Right? Screaming at a person because they think abortion is right doesn't do anything, but it's certainly not an example of a shining light in a crooked and perverse generation holding forth the word of truth. It's just an angry rant, right? Should believers scream at each other? I know, it's got far-reaching implications. You know, go back over Jeremiah 28 and 29 and go through these questions again this week, as well as start on chapter 1 in your notebook and think about it. I love Jeremiah's letter to the exiles. I think it's so relevant for us today.